Greetings, friends. It's me, Dee Trussell, and this is the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. I send you love and joy wherever you may be, whether you're flying in a black helicopter using some super advanced technology to look through the roofs of homes, watching strangers hump while you gather data on the pheromones they're secreting to determine whether or not they're going to give birth to someone who could potentially destroy the United States of America as we know it, or if you're in a deep underground military bunker up to your elbows in alien guts, I'm just happy that you're listening to this podcast. And you're going to be glad that you're listening, because with us here today is Lance Bangs. Lance just released an awesome documentary called The Elephant Six Recording Company. It's in theaters now. I hope you'll go see it. If you can't make it out to the theaters, I hope you'll stream it. It is amazing. If you love music, you're going to love this, because it's an exploration of a rock collective known as the Elephant Six Recording Company that launched Neutral Milk Hotel, the Olivia Tremor Control, and the Apples in Stereo. Lance is just cool. And I'm not saying that because he just directed my comedy special. I'm saying it because I've known him for a long time. And not only is he a great filmmaker, he is a true champion of comedians and artists. And I learned so much from talking with him today. We had a wonderful conversation about self-imposed obscurity and whether or not it's the right move to keep your art hidden from the world. We're going to jump right into this episode, but first I want to invite you to come see me at Cobbs in San Francisco. That is coming right up. It's going to be next Friday and Saturday, if you're listening to this on September 30th. So come see me at Cobbs in San Francisco. Also, I'm going to be at Helium in Philadelphia on the 12th of October, the 13th of October, the 14th of October, the Spokane Comedy Club in November. Lots of dates coming up. I hope you will come see me live. Also, subscribe to the Patreon at patreon.com/DTFH. You get commercial-free episodes of this podcast, and we hang out usually about once a week. Join your true family. Come home. Come home. Are we going to send you initially into the learning shed to pure you, to purify you of all your darkness? Yes. But once you come out, you're going to be born again and ready to hug, because we have really long hugging sessions and platonic makeout sessions that I'm sure you will love. That's patreon.com/DTFH. Okay, everybody, please welcome back the wonderful Lance Bangs. Lance Bangs, welcome back to the DTFH. It's been too long, man. How you doing?
It's been so many years, Duncan.
Insane. Like, ridiculous. I don't know why we aren't doing this regularly.
We've had so many good conversations with each other, but we just haven't recorded anything.
Well, I know. Yeah. I mean, well, that's one of the coolest things is, like, I just have gotten lucky and been, like, in your proximity, like, over the last year, which has been really wonderful. Like, you introduced me to Ruby. You shot my comedy special. It's so cool. You're like my angel.
Do people know that you have a comedy special in the works?
Oh, yeah. They've heard me talking about it. They do know. I mean, yeah, they do know. And, like, comedians, man, when you were, like, around the mothership, they're like, is that Lance Bangs? What's he doing here? He's shooting my special. It made me feel so important.
It was such a great experience. I'm so glad that we manifested it.
Well, you tricked me.
I did trick you.
you did this incredible trick. I mean, I'm so lucky you did that, because for folks listening, shot this special and I thought we were just going to do like one camera, because I was thinking maybe I'll just do an album. And then at the end of the weekend, I went in the back and there's like a billion cameras. He'd hidden like a whole full comedy special. Somehow you hid a whole production from me, which was...
And you started meeting all of the camera crew and audio crew.
I'm like, what the fuck? This is incredible. Because I was already, I felt like there were good shows, and I was already kind of bummed. I was like, oh, should have done it, done with, had more cameras, and should have like done a, what you need for a spec. And then it was like a dream. Like, there it was. So thank you.
Yeah, because you had sort of told me different dates of when the shows were going to be.
Yeah. And very disorganized.
There was like, you seemed like you might be comfortable doing like an audio only thing, like an album, or that maybe we would animate or create, you know, reshoots or virtual imagery to correspond to each section of the show, which creatively was exciting and would have been great. But I wanted to have the reference imagery to begin with of you on stage in that room with the audience from multiple angles to actually have the ability to make a special if we wanted to do it more visually.
Yeah. So cool, man. So cool. What have you done? Like 7 comedy specials now? Like 7 you did? I think it's, or more.
I think it's a lot more.
How many have you done?
I've done dozens, I think.
Hold on. Let me look. Let me tell you what you've done.
Okay.
Let me find it. It's a really impressive list, man. Really great comics.
Who's impressed by lists? No one's impressed by lists.
Well, you know, they say, I heard Jack Kornfield say that in Buddhism, God is lists. Marin, Chelsea Peretti, Todd Barry, Brent Morin, Hannibal Buress. These are like serious David Cross. God, I saw him do stand-up. I love his stand-up.
He's great. Michelle Wolf is a great one that I loved.
Michelle Wolf. And so I guess Wikipedia doesn't list all of them. No. John Hodgman, Ragnarok. That's so cool. How did you, when 20, you said 2013, you just got into comedy specials. Why?
No, it was before that, because I'd mostly been making personal films or documentaries or directing a lot of music videos for bands or serious heavy like HBO documentaries about AIDS treatment in Central Africa, kind of a range of different films. But then David Cross and Bob Odenkirk from Mr. Show were fans of, you know, independent music, underground music in the 90s when they were doing Mr. Show.
Yes.
And so I was kind of hanging out with them while they taped Mr. Show. And then they asked about, like David Cross didn't want to do the typical specials as they existed at that time, where like Showtime or HBO would have you in a theater and it'd be super lit and artificial for the audience experience and not the right way that comedy really feels. So he wanted me to make something that was more like the documentaries that I would do with Pavement or Nirvana or R.E.M.
That's
where
cool.
It was sort of like a handheld travel type of a thing. So we made a film called Let America Laugh that was, you know, kind of in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, him going out on the road and doing uncomfortable political material in rock venues as standing audiences rather than sit down comedy clubs as they existed at that time.
Jesus Christ. He's so ballsy. That's fucking nuts.
It was nuts.
That is
and so
nuts.
We got sued. We got, you know, there were like hassles along the way. People
What'd you get sued for?
Well, it was kind of, there was a venue in Nashville, Tennessee that is like a long running great music venue called the Exit Inn. And they had, you know, booked the show. And when you booked that tour, you were agreeing that like we were going to be filming.
Yeah.
By booking the show, you knew that there would be cameras there and that, you know, you might appear on camera in the audience. We would post signs about it, but that they might appear on camera and that a documentary is being filmed. The person running the show at that time had put on the marquee like Mr. Show. And David was like, no, it's not Mr. Show. Like the other guy's not here. It's me. I'm David Cross. I'm doing stand-up.
That's so annoying.
Yeah. But, and so, you know, you can imagine in Nashville, Tennessee, it would have helped that local promoter if it said,
yeah,
with the HBO series, but like, that wasn't what was happening
right there
that night. And so David was trying to clarify that. And the guy was a little bit like, oh, I'm not getting all the way back up on that ladder to go change it. People come, whatever.
I'm going to just fucking lie.
Yeah,
so, I'm going to just deceive the whole audience because I don't want to go on a ladder.
Yeah. And so the rest of that day, there was a lot of things where he wanted to be able to like sell hot dogs during the show.
Why? Who is this? What a fucking
all these
maniac.
Kind of like noisy
I'm
things.
I'm selling my dogs.
Yeah. All these like noisy things that would be in the way of like where the people would be standing to watch a comedy show. So then he wanted to like put in tables so people could sit and eat. And David's like, no, it's better if it's like a rock show and they're standing. And so at the end of the night, like David also had like a band opening. They'd loaded out. And David didn't really have any equipment. Like everyone else that's performing there that week has got bass amplifiers and drum kits and keyboard cases and boxes of merchandise, whatever.
Yeah.
So there's an amount of time that normally happens to kind of load out to your van at the end of the show. He only had like a backpack with like maybe some Pedialyte to mix with vodka and a poster. But he was pretending that it was taking like 40 minutes to figure out like, how do I get this poster into, let me start over. You know, just like excruciatingly long process of loading out so that we could hang out and keep talking and filming. So the person got more and more aggravated. And then he sued because he, you know, the footage appears in the documentary that Sub Pop put out called Let America Laugh. When a comedian or an entertainer starts their own production company to kind of like legally protect themselves, like you pick a name. Like, I don't know if you have one, Duncan, but like there might be like a name. And what is the name of yours?
Raytheon.
Yes, exactly. And so.
Oatmeal Maiden is my.
Okay. So in your instinct to say Raytheon, like that's the kind of thing that similarly David Cross would think was funny. And
yeah,
you know, so when you get to pick a legal entity or name, he chose Liberal G-Run Media. And so that's very funny when you're putting that at the end of your writing project, you know, but when you get sued in Cox County, Tennessee, and the lawsuit is local guy versus Liberal G-Run Media, all of a sudden it's not as funny and your chances
I knew it. I told you. Did I not tell you? That's what we're up against, honey. I just wanted to sell my dogs.
So, yeah, that was like a setback during that one. But after that, other comedians saw like that I could make things that were not in the kind of mold of like an overlit Showtime special circa 1998 and started hiring me to make
cool stuff,
more idiosyncratic or interesting comedy specials. And I've had great experiences with people collaborating and kind of figuring out the structure of their set or what's working or not working. Like I'll tend to go visit people in a few cities as they kind of work the material up and structure things and try out different endings or closings or find themes or callbacks or ways of kind of pacing a set or working through nervousness or restless energy or things like that to kind of get them in a good situation.
You're so good at that. Your process of working with me up to the special, it's like you know me. And you know that the special, for some reason, has been the apocalypse for me. It's so scary. And like you, the way you helped me to like get the set together and your recommendations, it's so gentle too. It's like, you're like a comic whisperer. Like we're such freaks. You know, you can like freak us out just so easily.
Yeah.
And so the way you did it was really cool, man. Confidence building. Like it's such an incredible skill set, man. Cause like we're weirdos and we love what we do, but you know, like most of us, especially with the special, you know, now that I've done one, like meeting comedians when they've got one coming up, like I have all this compassion for them now cause I know how they're feeling. And it's like, it's birth. I guess the scan would be the show, but you just don't know what kind of baby you're going to have. So you're like a midwife. That's what you are. You're a special midwife.
And it can go wrong. Like there are people who have great material that they've put an hour, you know, year and a half of their life assembling, traveling, trying out, restructuring. And then if it's not recorded or shot with the right tone or a matching energy to what they're going for, it sort of sabotages that year of work.
That's it. Yeah. All that stuff too, because you don't know, we don't know anything about that. Like we know how to, we're telling jokes. Like we don't know about the technical reality of a special, which if you didn't understand all the components that you need for the thing to be okay, miking the audience, you know, all that stuff, you would just think it should be easy. Just set up a camera, right? Like they're just talking into a microphone. What's the big deal? Like you don't realize it's like, no, it's a production. Like there's so much involved. I remember when you started telling me all that was involved and I had this dumb idea about it. I'm like, I'll just set up a camera. You know, we got lights and microphone. It'll be fine. I'm going to sell my dogs, Lance. Do you ever like, do you have any like movies? Like since we've been working on this, you're shooting like seems like you're every week you're going somewhere to shoot a music video. Do you have any like movies coming up or anything like that?
Yeah, I've got a movie that's out right now. It's in theaters and it's on Apple Plus and Amazon Prime Video and places like that. It's called The Elephant Six Recording Company, and it's a documentary. I travel a lot, but I was living in Athens, Georgia throughout the 1990s and through the early 2000s. My roommates included like Jeff Mangum from Nutrimilk Hotel, Julian, who's also in Nutrimilk Hotel and has another project called The Music Tapes.
Jesus.
And Orbiting Circus and members of like Elf Power and other bands. And so—
Wait, before you answer the question, I'm sorry. And then maybe you were about to answer what I'm about to ask you. How did that happen? Like, cause you ended up in a bubble of like genre defining, like future, like legendary stars. Like, how did that happen? Like,
I kind of feel like sometimes I put myself in those places. Sometimes I travel to things that are interesting to me or that are on my antenna or sensitivity to the things that are emerging. Other times I kind of find people and like mentor or support them as they grow through things and kind of bring attention to them or help other people know about the work that they're doing. But I left home as a teenager. I went down to Athens, Georgia in 1990 and was living there while it was a great music scene, doing a lot of stuff with the band REM.
Yeah.
And other bands that would come through like Nirvana and Pavement and Sonic Youth and My Bloody Valentine that were kind of fellow travelers or of a shared sensibility would collaborate with them or work with them or make things with them and then travel with those bands to other places and go out to the Pacific Northwest and—
Whoa.
—then or California or New York and sort of keep making things in different settings or environments. So in that time of the early 90s in Athens, it was a really magical, great place. And these people from Ruston, Louisiana, high school friends, Jeff Mangum, a guy named Bill Doss, Will Cullen Hart, Robert Schneider, they all were like kind of freakazoid high school friends that were using 4-track recorders to make songs together, like your friend Emil was doing.
Yeah.
And making great music, just, you know, kind of for 5 friends to listen to or get excited about and making bands with each other. So like, you know, if you're drumming and I'm playing bass and you're singing, then it's got this name. And if it's you singing and me drumming, it's got this name and a different—
Oh, that's,
you know,
so funny.
And so
just the configuration changes the name of the band. That's so
totally
funny.
So there was like Synthetic Flying Machine and Cranberry Life Cycle and Nutrimilk Hotel and the Apples and Stereo and Olivia Tremor Control. And they were all kind of this cluster of great people. And most of them came to Athens, Georgia, like in 92, 93, drawn by what was already going on there.
Right.
Bands like Pylon and the B-52s and REM and 5-8 and Vic Chestnut. And so they kind of settled there. And it's a great, inexpensive place to live. Very supportive music scene. You can drive from there to Atlanta and Florida and Chapel Hill and Asheville. But you can also just sort of hide out and not have the attention of like magazines knowing every mistake that you make and every bad song that you put out before it was ready.
Well, so that was the quality of that. That was one of the ethics of that, whatever that that is, was like, it was a kind of, it was antithetical to the notion that the goal was fame or the goal was like standard pop star success. And so that kind of music always has with it, you feel like almost like a voyeur, you know, you're listening to it and you feel like, man, I don't even know if I should be listening to this. Like, this person is like, so it's so open and real and they don't seem okay. But they're not, you know, they know that. And so then it captures, I always try to think of the way to define that, man. And it's like, it's haunted. That music is haunted and incredible. And once you love that kind of music, it's really hard to pull your way.
Absolutely.
To pull out of it, to hear other music and like love it the same way you love that when you've heard someone just ripping their heart open. And the technology they're using to record it somehow is a fractal, because the technology and their ability to use the technology is maybe not that great. And so there's these flaws in it that are so beautiful that match the flaws in them. And so it creates this resonance between the equipment and the music that's where it gets like, that's where it breaks into some archetypical like world soul or something, you know, the eternal outsider. God damn, that's so crazy you were hanging out with him, man. That's where it gets like, that's where it breaks into some archetypical like world soul or something, you know, the eternal outsider. God damn, that's so crazy you were hanging out with him, man.
Yeah.
So go on.
Sorry. So started filming and recording the people. And like you said, they were willfully obscure. They were not seeking any kind of recognition or attention for themselves as personas, but rather the music that they're creating with these kind of fictional identities and shared identities and collective identities and sense of community and building things in versions of themselves that were combinations of their life force, but not their ego. And
yeah.
So it really was magical. And I filmed and contributed and made things in that world and then would kind of pass out, you know, VHS or cassette copies of some of that to people when I would travel to other places. When Jeff Mangum made the Nutrimilk Hotel record on Avery Island in 96, and then in the Airplane Over the Sea in 98, larger parts of the world started hearing that and being like, oh my God, this is something really transcendent and genuine and mystical. And he's tapped into something and started emotionally connecting to it. And then he kind of went into a seclusion. So we were living together and he sort of started turning down all the things that were being asked or offered of him to kind of go on larger tours or open for other bands or make new batches of recordings. And when you're living with someone and that happens, you don't understand that that's it right away. You think like, oh, they're just sort of, they've got mono or they're resting or they're chilling out for a minute or recuperating or recharging. And then as time passes and you realize like, oh, it's been a year and they're still turning everything down and needing time to be quiet and refocus or whatever. So stayed in contact with him as he went different places throughout the years after that. And people became more sort of fixated or would knock on the door or turn up looking for him. And people who'd emotionally connected with the music were very much wanting to come express what they'd gotten out of it or what it meant to them or what they thought he was transmitting to them. And I think that also was probably overwhelming. So became very protective of his privacy and his work, and people started trying to take copies of footage that I'd shot and like disseminate them or charge money for them or, you know, put them out and take credit for it, and had to be kind of very careful of how that material was seen or distributed or shared for quite a while, but finally found the right version of making this film, this Elephant Six recording.
Jesus, it's going to be so
film.
Good. Can't
it's
wait
great.
To see
so
it.
It's out. I'll send you a copy to watch, and it's in theaters, and it's also available for people on like Apple TV Plus or Apple Plus, whatever it's called, or Amazon Prime Video or places like that. But also go see it projected if it is in your theater, your town, because it's a great experience to see large. I kind of wanted to steer it into being like a portrait of creativity and communal work and encourage these kind of bubbles to exist in places like Asheville, where you had been for a bit.
Yeah.
Is a city where things like that are going on. And it, you know, different times and different scenes, musically, culturally, poets, writers, painters. These kind of collectives that emerge are fascinating to me, and I love when they develop and hope that more people do things like that.
Well, one of my favorite Daniel Johnston lyrics is from Deviltown, and it's, there are strange secret cults in every town. And, you know, that sums it up because, I mean, I don't want to call these bubbles cults, but they kind of are. They do, there is a pattern to them. One like, you know, I think the general assumption, and it's a very sad assumption many of us make, is that, you know, talent will inevitably become mainstream. Inevitably, talent will like rise up out of the secret bubble that it has appeared in. And it's what is it? God, oh my God, Brian Eno. What's this? He's got that. The word is genius, the genius of a scene, and how like any of these people that have become famous, that's just the spokesperson. Like Ram Dass, for example.
Yeah.
When you go to these Ram Dass retreats, there's 15, 20 Ram Dasses there who didn't become the popular Ram Dass, but went to India with him and are just like as like awake as he was. And which is a wonderful thing to see. And like anytime you have any of these people, surrounding them is also people who no one will ever hear about. But then where it gets really fascinating is, and I love thinking about this, is like right now, God only knows how many musicians, artists, performers are out there that are 100 times better than the most popular anybody right now and don't want the shit because they're too smart and they recognize the price you have to pay. And the price you have to pay is a complete destruction of your anonymity, which seems to be the fertilizer for what they create. Lack of privacy, and the worst thing is the co-opting of what you're doing and the warping of it by default reality, so that inevitably what you're doing just gets so like twisted and watered down, and somehow even the masses loving it dilutes it to some degree, and they recognize that, and so they rabidly guard their. They try to keep the thing from growing outside the garden. They're passionate about doing that. And so to me, that is so wild to think about, you know, and you're one of those people who somehow finds them. You know, I don't even know how you do that. Like, how do you do that? What is the, like, Ruby, like you bring Ruby to my show and like, I knew she was going to be funny because you brought her to the show and she does a spot and it's like, who the fuck is this? Like, she's so unique and so funny and like kills. Yeah. But how did you find Ruby?
I was traveling a lot during the pandemic. And I think we spoke a little bit during this time. I was driving back and forth from Portland, Oregon, where I live, down to Southern California or down to the Bay Area, or down to kind of like Arcata, Eureka areas. And in some of the trips to Sacramento, there's a folk singer named Trey Burt that I was making a film with. John Prine had sort of come across his work and signed him to John Prine's label before John passed away. And so we were making a short film that I wrote in Sacramento where Trey lived at the time. And I went to go see comedy at maybe like a bookstore, you know, just like a local strange stand-up thing, and saw Ruby, who was a young performer and is very singular and has their own voice and distinct, and felt like, what is this person doing in Sacramento, you know?
Yeah.
And remembered them and their work. And then I got asked to help put together a show for a new comedy festival in Portland, Oregon, and wanted to bring them up, and assumed I would just be like, you know, getting like a bus ticket or an inexpensive 45-minute flight from Sacramento to Portland.
Yeah.
And didn't realize that Ruby had just relocated to New York City, yeah, which means like traveling several days earlier to get out. You can't just like fly the same day from New York and land in Portland and be on stage reliably at like 7 o'clock at night or whatever. So brought Ruby out and had to explain like that this wasn't some scam or, you know, vampire trap or whatever. Like, no, like, you know, like you don't remember me, but I'm going to get you onto an airplane and bring you out for this festival that you've never heard before, that doesn't necessarily previously exist, and a venue that you haven't heard of, and it's going to be great. But it was like a really magical time. Like that May of 2023, you were coming to Portland to come perform. I'd seen you like a year earlier and talked to you about like, when are we going to make this special? Please stop avoiding it. It's been a decade since I've been trying to talk you into filming your material.
No.
At times I was going to have a bunch of drones film you and then encourage you to take them out one by one to end the special. You would be like, with a gun, you would have to like shoot all of the cameras to end the special being recorded.
Ah, those were the old days. That's an idea from the old days.
That's an idea from 2013 or 14.
That's the before times.
Yeah. So, like I was excited that you were about to perform and then this thing was going on. So Ruby and some other great people that I met in that couple of days were, I brought them to come see your show and come to the dressing room and have a conversation, and And you picked up on like how funny in the room Ruby is and how, you know, they're like unassuming and dry and sardonic and clever and not like desperate for attention or feedback. Like they're not as needy as some young performers can be.
That's right.
But they've got like their own sensibility and, you know, they most likely were nervous, but like they were funny. And you and
most importantly, they killed. You know, that's the thing. Cause it's like, you know, wonderful. Like to like be fun to hang out with and like, but you know, obviously like you gotta be funny and like, whoa, like, wow. Like there's been a few times on the road, man, where like following her has been a little like it's a bit of a challenge where you're like, shit, man, I gotta like, you know, like she's blown up the room. And it was just great. I love that. You know, okay. When was the last time you watched King Kong?
Oh, it's been years. Tell me about it.
Okay. King Kong, they go, you know, it's a love story. They capture King Kong. He's on this island. He's fighting pterodactyls. He's, you know what I mean? He's like, he's got his own thing going. They capture him. He's fallen in love. They bring him to New York City. And, you know, he isn't supposed to be in New York City. King Kong is supposed to be on this secret island in the middle of nowhere. And he's in love now. Not only have you just fucked his life by like, you know, introducing him to this, like, I don't know who she was, somehow some beautiful human, you know, woman. But then also you capture him, take him away from his home, bring him to New York City, and he like climbs the building, you know, to try to find his love, and just it's a tragic, sorry, spoiler, he gets shot down off the Empire State Building, gets to the top, gets shot down by the culture he was never supposed to be in. So do you think that, so you know, I go back and forth on this. I know you probably know people who right now are Neutral Milk Hotel, who are making art and music at that level, who don't want anyone to know who they are. And I flip-flop on it, man. Sometimes I'm like, man, that's selfish, like, of the artist. That's so lame of me to say, but it's like, people deserve to hear your art. It's going to help people. It's going to inspire people. It's going to heal people. It's going to make people better in the world. And yeah, you're going to lose your freedom and your anonymity, and you're going to lose your all these things that you cherish, but it's a worthy sacrifice for people hearing your music. And then sometimes I think they're right. Like, don't do it. Don't fucking do it. Don't let them take you off the island. Don't let them take you to New York City and you know what I mean? And give you the girl and give you everything you want, because they're just going to shoot you the fuck down once you get to the top. They're just going to fucking kill your ass. And you still have the rest of your life to live, but they're going to destroy you. So I go back and forth. What are your thoughts on this? And I don't, maybe it's the ethic of anonymity is less today than it was, you know, in those days. Maybe that's, everything's changed because of social media and the, you know, people don't have that, like, I don't know what you would call it. It's almost like a weird punk rock Gen X ethic. But what do you think, man? Do you think it's sometimes it's better for people to just keep using the four track?
Absolutely better for many people who are sensitive or delicate of spirit or mind, or, you know, vulnerable to like being destroyed by commerce, to preserve the sanctity of what they have inside them and what they can make by keeping it for a discerning audience of not oversaturation, but like under.
Yeah.
Like it's better to be scarce than to be like an onslaught of a sludge river.
Yes. Right.
And so like, I adore those people. I have those traits myself. I don't like to be perceived sometimes. I kind of keep low key and duck around and don't.
You do.
And I like that ability to kind of like move like a stainless steel rat unobserved.
You do that, man. And it's cool. I noticed that. It's so cool.
You're not supposed to notice that.
Well, you know why I noticed that? Because I've read books on witchcraft. And in witchcraft, you know, the witch can turn invisible. And I'm not calling you a witch, but that's not an insult anyway. Hi. But I read some analysis of that as being like, it's not literally invisible. You know, there's that famous like Marilyn Monroe story where she's eating at a diner with her friend and nobody sees her. And then she says to her friend, you want to see what happens? You want to see Marilyn? And then like does whatever her like magical power is. And everyone like immediately just turns and notices her. Like she uninvisibled herself. So I notice it like that. It's like, whoa, he's like, you go invisible. Like you're people don't see you. Like it's stainless. I didn't think stainless steel rat. I don't think of you as a rat, but I noticed that.
So that's often how I kind of preserve my sensibility or antenna or ability to not be dragged into things is being discreet or slipping away. I think that's essential to what I do and how I work and what I care about and what people respond to.
Yeah.
But, yeah. It is also generous to give oneself to... If you're the vessel or channel for songs that will enrich other people's lives and give them memories or connections to others or things like that, it is a generous thing to become that conduit, even knowing that it's going to like damage or fuck up some of your own development or growth or long-term relationships.
Yeah. Some people really just don't, I don't think there's any way you can prepare for what it's like, but some people, they just absolutely don't need that. It will kill them and it will ruin them. And it's like poison, you know? And that's really sad when that happens to people because they don't know how to, especially if it happens like too fast to people, you know? It's like, I think one of the cool things about comedy is it can be a nice slow boil, you know, like maybe too slow sometimes, but so that by the time you have some recognition from people, you've been around it long enough to not be completely melted down by it. It's like when I was working at the Comedy Store, every once in a while, a comedian would pop too fast and they would like lose their shit. And Mitzi would say, everyone goes crazy, honey. And she meant like that. Like she watched so many comics just like get sucked into that stuff and just go, their ego gets inflated. They get hyper defensive. They start treating people in a rotten way because they're so defensive and like, and then like they just burn out and now they're just devastated. Their lives are wrecked and because it was too fast. But yeah. You don't have to name anybody, but do you know any people like that right now? Like people that if they were exposed to the world, they would probably become like famous musicians or.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are people I love and I like working with them in a small, low-key way and sort of helping to broaden what they can do or what they're thinking of in their work or channels that they can kind of pour energy into that kind of like raise things up. But I'm also protective of them and don't want to, you know, see them end up on the wrong places getting their work, you know, blown out in a way that's not healthy or conductive.
Right. Yeah. That's it's just like when you realize it's like the dark web, you know, the dark web is not the dark web. It's just like websites that have told Google, the Google web crawler, not to identify them. You know, that's what it is, right? There's more. The thing we call the internet is like the tip of the iceberg of what the actual internet is. And people get confused and they think like when they're Googling this or that they're getting like everything when they're not, they're getting just whatever the web crawlers have identified and what there's so much more going on. And it's so like, I don't know. It just gives me the like best feeling, like knowing like, my God, all these bubbles, all these little cults filled with talented freaks that no one will ever know about that are actively avoiding being known about. It's not secret societies. It's better than secret societies. It's like all these art collectives out there that are just, and what's so funny is when you meet them, and if you're like a Hollywood pig like me, and you realize they don't want any of that shit, no. Legitimately. Like, they don't care about money. They don't care about fame. They want to be able to pay their rent and eat and stuff like that. But they don't want it. And you when you meet them, it's like once you overcome, like, you get past your own personal shame, you're like, what the fuck? I'm a monster compared to you. I'm a monster. I'm the King Kong that learned to live on the Empire State Building. You know what I mean? There's just something so beautiful about that. Because you realize, oh, there's still wild things in the world. It hasn't all been domesticated. It doesn't all absolutely. Have fences around it. And I love that.
Yeah, there's absolutely pockets of that and fascinating people, or even like other beings that may not even be people, just like entities that are choosing not to be seen or be scrutinized or picked apart or devoured by the people that would be interested.
Yeah, well, and there's something when you're, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about there. I mean, I have some ideas from my own experience, but my encounter with that is that that's compassion, because the recognition there is like most people aren't, they don't like seeing that level of reality. It's not, they're not right. They don't need that right now. Like, they still have to work on the earth realm stuff, you know? And so, like, even though those beings, I think, sometimes might really want to help or want to like be there for you, or and there are there for you in like really subtle ways, you just think you had some epiphany or some shit, you know, like you're like, well, that was a great idea in the shower. You don't know, something was whispering in your ear. But yeah, I think they know. And also, you know, these, like, a lot of these spiritual people that I've met, like, there's like, I think they have some capacities that they don't really lead with at all, if they ever lead with them at all, because they don't want to deal with, they don't want you to like get fixated on, oh, well, yeah, you can read minds, or, oh yeah, like, this is possible, because then you're going to get all like, you're going to go Faustian or something, you know, you're gonna want that power. You're going
to
want
you're going to want to,
you know, and that's,
you're going to want that power.
Yeah. Yeah. And God, help you, God help you. That's cool. Yeah, I have a, I won't mention their name. Yeah, Emil and I both know somebody who, my God, this is the best music I've ever in my life. And to this day it is. I'll revisit it sometimes and expecting like, yeah, it's going to be, I won't like it now. And I'm wise and older. And it's just like, God, it's beautiful. And a long time ago, I played it on an episode of a podcast. I hadn't heard from this person in years. Totally impacted my life, this person. That's the other thing. It's like when you meet those people, it's not like they teach you. It's not like they're like, sit down and let me Andrew Tate you, or, you know, let me like be your mentor. But they're so actualized that just being in the presence of them helps you become more actualized. You're around a wild human, you know? And I can remember, like, I shouldn't have done it. Great regret about doing this. I shouldn't have done it. Played one of his fucking songs on the podcast. Episode, it's gone. You can't find anyone listening. You won't be able to find it. Next day, phone call. And like, I deserved what he said to me. He's like, you know, if you don't take that down, you're just like them. And I felt so, he was so right. And I felt so bad, like a Judas, a betrayer. I took it down. But yeah, that person, man, one of the coolest people I ever met in my life.
Yeah.
Wild. So he taught me something, which is, we like to imagine those people show up only in the East. Those people only show up in like remote locations. They're not going to grow out of America. There's no American saint, no American guru, no America. That is not the case, man. They're here. They're everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. But they just don't want, they don't want to deal with it. So that's cool. So yeah, you're kind of just like, I don't mean to reduce what you're doing here, because I think it's incredible, but you know, like, I have friends who are into records. You seem to be, you have a bunch behind you there, and they pick through crates and they find these rare records. It seems like you're doing that, but out in the world or something. Is that an intentional?
Yeah, that's fair. That is intentional. I ran away from home a bunch and traveled and really was drawn to kind of go to places that seemed interesting to me, or that things were maybe happening, or that someone that caught my eye, or that I felt compelled to go spend time around, and sort of covered a lot of ground in the world, like going to different places when I would be excited about things, or see a photograph where the lighting looked interesting in Portland, Oregon, or heard music in Minneapolis that seemed compelling to me, and would kind of drift to places and spend time there. And then kind of built a life where I can do that, where I'll go, you know, like I also work in very broad commercial things sometimes. Like there's like, you know, Prank Panel on ABC with Eric Andre and Johnny Knoxville is like I'm not only doing like obscure, micro nuanced investigations of things, but then taking the proceeds or funding from those things to support a lifestyle where I'm traveling and making fun things happen, or bringing friends along to work and collaborate with, or putting together teams of like-minded fellow travelers to like have great experiences or make things or collaborate with, and going to places that I'm compelled by or interested in.
That is, you have this nomadic life. Also, you've been, as a dad now.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're a dad and
you're a dad.
We're dads. Your kid is so cool, man. You know what I mean? Like you, what do they say? You shall know the father by the son. And your son is fucking awesome, man. Like you did such a good job. Like it's not like whatever this nomadic lifestyle is, somehow you've also been tending to the hearth as well, clearly. So how do you do both? How do you balance out? Like, you know, for me, I go on the road and my road life is so non-rock starry. Like I just like to come back to the hotel and watch Forensic Files and go to bed, play video games. But still coming back home, I have to reacclimate. It's a completely different rhythm, you know? So how do you balance these two, I guess you could call them polarities, you know, like hanging out with comics, hanging out with rock stars, hanging out with stars. How do you like, when you get home, how do you like retune into that? Or is there no difference for you?
I guess just knowing who you are and what your values are, and making that the center or core of your life, so that it, you know, the connection with I've got two kids. I've got a son who, you know, who's 22 and a daughter who's 15 that you've met briefly, but not really gotten to know or hang out with extensively. And I would love to bring her to, you know, future adventures. She's kind of like very diligently deep in the academic world of high school at the moment. But they both like traveling. They both like going on adventures with me. They both are very compatible to, you know, going and exploring strange places and being out in the world and meeting people and not being, I don't know, like they both are compatible with me and making things and traveling and exploring. So I don't know. I was so glad that you and Marshall get along. Like that was great to see him. Like,
how could you not get along with Marshall? Like,
no, he's amazing. Yeah. Such a good guy. And he was like very effective in like things he's picked up or observed, or, you know, like shortcomings or faults that I have about some things. Like he's suited to kind of like pick up on or fill in those gaps, or like make the whole production better by the things that he's observed and knows how to like augment or cover. And so he was like invaluable in making your special stronger and better covered than it might have been if he hadn't been there.
Also, he picked up your, what did you call it? Steel rat?
No,
like,
yeah.
He picked up that ability to like just like vanish, but be there.
Disappear.
Very powerful ability. As a dad, that is a, you know, like you fall in love with these kids.
Yeah.
And there's this thing hanging over your head that every parent has that you have to exercise out of your life because you want your kids to be their own people. I mean, my kid's only 4, but already I'm like, oh, I'm going to lose him.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like, you have to. Like, they have to go live their own
life. Yeah, they got
to
go be their own life.
Yeah, but, you know, so you have this thing, and it's far away, but it's still hanging there in the future. You know it's coming. So like to see you working with your kid out on the road, I'm like, whoa, you know, that is the, you know, that's so old school too, man. That's so old school. You're the family business. It's just so cool.
Yeah, I should clarify that he's willing to do that in like short doses of exciting things to come work with you in Austin, Texas, But okay. In life in general, damn. He's got his own, like...
All right, thank you for blowing up my fantasy.
The truth is, he's got his own, like, path and trajectory that he's on in life that will involve adventures that were, you know, it's not the two of us together doing things. It's him in his own rampage.
Okay, I get it. Okay, damn. All right, that makes a lot more sense, actually. Yeah.
But it's great that he can also, like, come be a great, you know, contributor and part of the magic of making something.
Do you, how many things do you have to say no to at this point in your career?
A lot. I enjoy it. I enjoy being discerning. Like, I make a million things, but I also, like, other friends have kind of taught me that there's a strength in, like, saying no or defining things by the things that you reject or that you don't allow to, like, over swamp your life or entangle right. you in places that you don't want to get caught up.
Right. Yeah, that's so hard to do. I mean, was it that you, were you always like that? I mean, it seems like, you know, when your work started getting out in the world and you started experiencing the acceleration that we're talking about, you were able to, like, adapt to it and you wanted that. But was there a point where you were just, like, doing anything?
No, I think I was always kind of selective about not wanting to kind of cheapen or degrade what I respect about my own work by making it available to things that were, like, people that I didn't respect or feel like would be a good fit for what I can make. Like, you don't want to just, like, degrade it all by making things that are disposable or for gross people.
Okay. Then I won't share your email with all the musicians who want to send you their music right now. I'm in a micro cult. Listen, we only play balloons with our dicks. It's incredible.
I'm an active listener. I would love to hear anything, but I don't want to, like, commit that I'm going to go make a documentary about someone who's, like, a creep within, like, the El Paso scene or something.
A creep within the El Paso. I want to see that. Do you ever think, like, do you have any plans for making fiction? Do you know what I mean? Like a nice, like, I think you could make the best fucking horror movie ever. I don't know why. I just keep thinking, yeah. Like, man, if Lance decided to make, like, what's that great production company? A24?
Sure.
That the name? Yeah. Oh, my God. They make such great, like, crazy art. Do you ever, like, play around with that idea?
Yeah. There's been times that I've directed, like, scripted non-documentary things. I did a TV series called Better Things with Pamela Adlon, who created it. And, you know, it really was her thing that she wrote and created based on her life and made amazing stuff. But they brought me in to direct a bunch of episodes in the first season and had a great experience doing that. History of the World, the Mel Brooks comedy, I directed some sections of, like, the version of that that came out last year. Like, I like working in fiction pieces as well, but have an aptitude for making things conjured out of real life or documentary or, yeah.
But I'm telling you, you are perfectly set up to make the best found footage movie ever.
Oh my God, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you know how to do that. You know how, like, what it looks like. You already have the gear. You already have the crew.
Yeah.
And the like, just what we just talked about, there is a shadow side to it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like I can remember when I was in my own little micro cult in Asheville, and it was a true micro cult, like a true fucking cult. Like, without, like, I don't think I'm giving, like, I don't, and I was on the outskirts of this cult, thank you, Jesus. But I think there was, like, all these people in it called themselves John, and with a number on the other side of it, like John 4, John 9. And it sounds insane, but I mean, in a small town, these things can develop. Like, these like, weird cultures develop, and it sounds absolutely silly, but, like, they're sinister. Like, there was a kidnapping, like, some kid got kidnapped and duct taped to a chair. They were all into, like, magic and the occult and drugs and raves and these little, you know, like, just the small town club. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, you go to a small town and you go to the, like, little tiny club, but it's playing, like, insane music, like Aphex Twin, like, shit that you've never heard before. And back then that was new, or, like, God, what was the name of that? They were all, you remember Psychic TV? Genesis P. Orridge?
Yeah.
That was a little cult. And they were all into that. And they would religiously watch that stuff. And like, I just remember like, there's this weird resonance that was happening between the micro cult and the occult and like the still underground rave scene and the eerie quality of Asheville, the Blue Ridge Mountains, the strangeness of like Appalachia and the generational poverty and and those two things were like mixing in this like haunted little industrial town. I don't know, man. It was creepy. Nothing ever happened to me.
Oh yeah. You're saying that now.
What do you mean? You think something happened?
Things play out over longer timelines than what you've lived so far.
Oh, Jesus Christ almighty. You got to make a horror movie. That's what I'm talking about, man. That's what I'm fucking talking. I can remember being in one of these clubs and like all of us were young. And like, you know, I don't know the dude's name or remember, but just like watching him give like drugs to like kids, like me being one of them. Oh, we weren't complaining, but the way he would say like candy for my babies. You know what I mean? Like, fuck. Whoa, dude, what are you doing? You're giving fucking ecstasy and acid to like 17-year-olds because you want to fuck some of them. What are you doing? And we liked it. And what, you know, like, whoa, man, you could make the best fake documentary about discovering one of these scenes, finding the thing. Oh, please do it. I'm just saying this out of selfishness, Lance. Like, I would just like to watch that. I love found footage stuff.
This is a movie that you want to see.
Yeah, it's, you know, Twin Peaks kind of grabbed it. You know what I mean? Like David Lynch tuned into this thing we're talking about, the weird shit that happens in small towns that no one ever hears about that is absolutely scary and dark. Like he captured it for sure. But, you know, but like connecting it to music and connecting it to a general rejection of default reality and all the jewels and baubles it tries to offer you, you know.
People who listen to this show are aware that there's more than default reality.
No, I know, but it's, you have to remind yourself. If you don't, it's a constant reminder to yourself, right? Like when I forget to remind myself that the news isn't necessarily a depiction of reality or whatever's on my Twitter feed is not reality, Instagram's not necessarily reality, I get depressed. Like I start feeling like the world is collapsing and everything's horrific, you know? So I have to constantly remind myself like, no man, you're in your own little filter bubble. There's all kinds of things going on out there that are wonderful or wonderfully dark.
Many worlds are collapsing, to be
fair.
You
think so?
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean? Biomes and stuff?
Yeah. But like, there are definitely a lot of things that are falling apart and a lot of existences that are collapsing and a lot of existences that are.
Not denying that. And for sure. I mean, absolutely. Like it's a lot of transformations happening on the planet for better or for worse. And a lot of it's for worse. But. Yeah. But then I don't know that is, I think it's unique to the time. Like the things that we're contending with right now are unique to the times in the same way all the other things in the past were unique to the times and equally potentially an existential threat to humanity. You know, my God, yes. Like the Spanish fucking flu.
Yeah.
It just burned itself out. We got lucky with that one. That could have wiped everybody out.
Yeah,
and they think it has happened to civilization. It's just, you know, a disease mutates just the right way. Boom. Gone. Like, gone. All you needed is for COVID to be like 10% more deadly.
Yeah.
You know, and that would be the end of the world.
What do you think happened to everyone in Roanoke?
Oh, I love you're bringing that up. So Croatoa. What was it carved into the tree?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was Croatoa. Like, so like nobody knows what the fuck they were trying to say. It's like it was a settlement, right? It just disappeared. Like a settlement just vanishes. And nobody knows what happened. And it's a great mystery to this day. There's all these theories that maybe they were assimilated. That's one of the theories by like indigenous Americans are assimilated. Another is they were murdered. But yeah, this entire community just disappeared. What are your theories on that?
Like just the notion of, you know, things could have played out differently with on a large scale, the Spanish flu, and that there are civilizations that may have been wiped out at different times. Like on a smaller scale, in a more condensed, more geographically specific area, when a small culture just vanishes and goes away, if you had any thoughts about what might have happened in that particular one.
Well, that one, you know, is like, I think it stands out more than all the other ones, maybe because it's a little more recent. You know, it's like when you know, news pops up that they've used some new scanning technology and they've discovered like massive cities buried by the Amazon. They've discovered massive cities that, you know, no one knew, or they you know, they'll stumble upon cultures and they'll have no idea what they are. Their language is different. Their writing is different. They have no idea. And you know, I think a lot of people, we think those people aren't like us. Like we think we're there's probably some anthropological name for the way that present cultures always look like this kind of temporal form of like being a bigot. Like you know what I mean? Like, because we are in what we consider to be the current, assuming there's like just this moment and all things aren't happening simultaneously, we think, oh, we've got it all figured out. Like we are different from them. Like, yeah, their city disappeared because they were fucking whatever. They're building with rocks. Fuck them. They weren't like us. They didn't feel like us. They didn't have kids like us. They didn't
10 years ago, people. Yeah. 10 years ago, people were so unsophisticated.
Yeah, exactly. No, and you do see the micro version of that in any cool thing. Burning Man, the classic example. You know, old burners are, you know, they're just like, when we were doing it, it was right. New burners are like, fuck those old geezers. What the fuck? This is fun. And like, so this weird time judgment pops up. And when you realize like, no, like those people were exactly like us, probably. They thought they were the most advanced. They probably were judging other ancient cultures in some weird way, like that cultures we'll never even know about. And they just, they're gone. Like New York, we think New York City. I don't know, I keep bringing up New York. We're going to remember New York City forever. It'll always be there. You can fly into LaGuardia. Like no one wants to think about like, no, actually the odds are just based on Earth history that at some point people are going to be like, what the fuck was that? Like, what is this?
Or even if it's still there in some form, like what's the big deal about Constantinople or whatever? Like, you know, it's no longer the massively valorized.
Yeah. Right. Rome.
Space. Yeah.
Rome. Like, yeah, that. And to me, like the way I mitigate some of my eschatological phobia or whatever you want to call it regarding the collapse of the environment or the collapse of Western civilization or whatever is, at least it's the norm. It's not anomalous. It's like, this is what happens on the planet, is just extinction, destruction, you know? And a lot of the times it's directly resulted to, it's connected to ignorance.
Yeah.
You know, like Pompeii, are you telling me they didn't fucking know there was a volcano there?
Right.
You tell, like, there was for sure someone in Pompeii who's like, I don't know.
We're at the bottom of a volcano right now.
Should we be here? Like, is this smart? And they're like, yeah, but what are you? Shut up. Why do you keep talking about the fucking mountain of fire? It's going to be fine.
Rumble Mountain.
Rumble Mountain is fine as long as we please the gods. We will. And then, like, yeah, you go look at the, God, that's haunting to look at the Pompeii mummies or whatever you call them. My God, just like in the midst of their lives with their kids and their dogs, humping, sleeping, gone. Good night, everybody. Good night. I hope you enjoyed this pun. It's like a dark way. I'm just kidding. I'm not.
We are about to hit 1 hour exactly. I'm not ready to stop talking.
Me either. Okay. I think that, the news has to sell ads. That's the first thing you have to remember about the news. Yeah. You forget that, then you will fall prey to the idea that whatever your particular flavor of fear of choice is an accurate depiction of reality. But you have to remember they're supported by the corporations, and the corporations need reality to seem a certain way.
Yeah.
And so you're going to get a warped idea of whatever's happening in the world from the news. We all know that. That's not news. but then also realize, like, our amygdalas don't want to hear all the good shit that's happening in the world. My amygdala doesn't. When I'm doom scrolling through whatever the fuck I'm doomed, I'm not going to stop on the woman saves the sheep from a bog. Like, I'm going right to the Ukrainian war footage because my amygdala is addicted to that shit. So the news knows this. So they're signal boosting. They're signal boosting the darkest shit they could find to sell ads. I mean, that's what's happening. And that's what I mean. Like, if you are fixated on that, that's the world you're going to be living in versus all the other wonderful things that are happening in the midst of the horror, in the midst of the nightmare, you know. And that stuff is like the people that we've been talking about. It's not trying to get famous. It's just trying to help. It's not, you know, it's not the people who are out there helping. They're not like, God, I hope I get a record deal from this. You know, they don't care. Monsters.
What did it feel like for you? And have you been aware of, like, the work you've done in stand-up comedy, which is separate from the outlet you have in these conversations that you do?
Yeah.
And other forms of writing that you do, to kind of, like, have preserved, like, an hour and 15 minutes or so of that in, like, a form. Did that feel like any kind of I've completed that step, or I've...
Yes. No, it was like this... It's like I've been carrying, like, just a bag of, like, moldy, wet clothes on a backpack, and all the shame of not doing it, and the fear, and knowing all my excuses for not doing it were generally related to fear, and that if you're making fear-based decisions in your life, then you're fucking up no matter what, and, like, all that stuff, and, like, and, you know, some of my comedian friends, you know, the way you are, like, sort of champion me doing a special in this really sweet, compassionate way, they're a little more, in Buddhism we call it wrathfulness, like a little more just like, hey, what are you, you're late. What's going on here? Where is it? What do you need? A body of work? You know, this, you got to do it. Like, what are you doing? Jump. You got to jump. And so all of that building up. And the moment I did it, I can't even explain that night after, like, it was like a literal, like, you hear a weight was lifted off of me. It was a weight. Like, it was just felt free and relieved and good about it. Like, to the point where, like, now it one really dark moment, I'm like, maybe I just won't even release this special. Who cares? I recorded it.
That's the important part.
So now I'm back to, like, the trick move, fear-based trickery. But yeah, it felt good, man. It felt good. It's an initiation kind of in comedy, right? Like, it's an you're initiated when you do that, like, somehow.
Yeah. The idea of a body of work within someone who performs in the vernacular of stand-up comedy. Like, are there things that you've done in the past where you feel like there's audio of that and I like that set, or that 5-minute bit from 2010 is recorded somewhere? Like, are there things that feel good about those things, like being... You know, 50 years from now, when people are talking about, like, the Mayans of this era, that something of the voice that you had is at least someone can, you know, hear that again.
Well, I'm really proud of, I guess it's not stand-up related. Like, there is something out there that I love that I didn't love when I did it, but now I love it. Which is, like, I went on Ari's show, This Isn't Happening, and talked about a bad acid trip I had in front of people. It wasn't really stand-up, it was just storytelling. And honestly, I wish that I'd spent more time punching up the story. I didn't put enough work into punching it up when he asked me to do it. I just got the beats of the story down and told the story. But I am proud of that. And like people will come up to me and like, you know, mention parts of it to me, which makes me feel really good because it seems like it resonated with every single person who's like taken too much acid at a concert and gone through that fucking hell. So yeah, that, but as far as like stand-up goes, no, because I've seen the thing where comics put their material online before they're ready.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that's a terrible mistake. Like, don't do that. Like, you've only been doing stand-up a few years. Like, even though that might be funny, what you put up, it's not going to be as funny as in like 4 years or something like that. And I think that's kind of a dated, antiquated, pre-TikTok, pre-Instagram way of thinking. That's an old school way of thinking that I think I absorbed through the Comedy Store. This is going to be I think this will be an actual special because it's like, it's special. I haven't done a special yet.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you tried that closing bit.
I know, man. I'm so glad. I'm
glad that we got that.
Glad we got that. I can't believe, I hope we can use it. I've got plans for that. We can't really talk about that one, but like I got plans for that one.
Yeah.
I think I might be able to get permission, man. We'll see. I don't know. But I'm thrilled with it. I'm going to feel weird editing it and going through like the, and also now it's cause I'm working on new material, but I'm still doing like some old jokes from that that are going to be on that special. And of course, like the more you do jokes, the more you find pieces of them, words that make them funnier. And so, you know, some of those jokes, I'm like, fuck, that word is so much better than that word, but I can't, it's not going to like, but you know, you just have to. I can remember when we were making the Midnight Gospel, Pendleton explaining to me, like, look, at some point you're done. Like, it doesn't matter if you feel like it's not done. You have to send it to them because there's a deadline and that's just the way it is. So, you know, I learned a lot from that because it's true. At some point you just have to like, you got to upload the podcast. You got to put out the episode.
Right on. And then you were at an interesting moment of your life. Like it was, you know, any day you are going to become a father for the third time.
Oh yeah, dude. That was wild. That was so wild. Cause that was wild. And my wife is so wonderful because like, even like she was encouraging me to do it. Like, cause I was like, no, let's just push it. You're about to have the baby. I don't want to like, what if you go into labor while I'm shooting the special? Like, and she was like, I wouldn't tell you. It was so sweet. It's like, Aaron, you got to tell, you can't do that. But so yeah, that karmically, that seems to happen to me a lot. Like all these things stack at the same time. Like all these weird, intense things tangle together. And it's been that way for a while. You know, it's been that way. Like I got testicular cancer right around when my mom died. So many like, just extra weird, such a hacky, extra balls to juggle, Papa. I'm sorry, I'll be here all week, guys. Wait till you hear the special. Every joke is just that good. Like stuff like that. So the pandemic, you know, we had a baby during the pandemic, which was really intense. We like, you know, we a lot stacks on top of each other. So I think Aaron and I have become really good at like dealing with like stress because of all of the training from the universe in that regard, where I can roll with stuff much better than I used to be able to. But that was a lot. It was a lot to do that, to like give birth to a special, you know, when my wife was about to give birth to my daughter.
How did you tell her about the feeling of having taped the special? And was she in a mindset where she could in any way like share that with you, or was it, you know, it's such an intense thing that she's in the last 48 hours before giving birth and you've just gone through this kind of thing that you want to share with her, but that she wasn't there to watch.
Oh no, she's incredible. No, she is like such a supporter of my stand up and such a, like, it's, she's incredible. Like she really like, she won't like she like because I'm I have a sadly a little bit of a lazy streak. She won't let me cancel a show. Like, yeah. If there's a show, I mean, I was in bed with her once in my underwear, and like Rogan texted me, like, it was a confusing text. I thought he was responding to a previous text I sent him. I didn't make any sense at all. It was like, let's go with like the, you know, an arm with a muscle. And I texted him something that didn't really connect to that. And I was like, yeah, man, I didn't understand. We're just watching TV. And then he calls. He's like, dude, where are you? You told me you were coming tonight. I'd completely forgotten. And you know, my instinct in those moments, like, dude, I'm sorry. I'm in bed. And I was about to do that. And she's like, no. Pointing to the closet, like, you're getting out of bed. You're getting dressed. You're going to do that show. You're not canceling anymore. So that she's perfect for me in that way, because like it's sad that I would need that. But so we're a good team in that regard, because she really pushes me. This is really sad. Like, over the course of the pandemic, I was podcasting, getting real comfortable, man. And really kicking around the idea of like, why do I need to go on the road again? Why even do stand up? I'll just podcast and that'll be my job. Why not just have one job? Why do I need to have a bunch of jobs? And I remember she had this intense conversation with me. She's like, you're a comic. You're not giving that up. Why would you? You are not. That's who you are. And or I would say I'm a podcaster to people. And she'd be like, why do you say that? You're a comic. Say you're a comic. You know, that's what you are. Yeah. Like, I just feel so lucky to have met her for that. You know, it's just so nice. Like, it's hard. Like, I can't even imagine what it's like to be married to me, much less to be married to like a comic going out on the road, and we're all neurotic and weird. And like, I have to deal with that. Like, I have to deal with like the kids at home while your husband is like laying in some hotel room bed, eating Doritos and watching TV. It's, you know, it's not fair in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking me that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. But I also imagine it's probably better than having to say that you're married to a podcaster.
Nobody wants to say, there you go.
Nobody wants to say that.
It would be better to be like, I'm married to like, he's a coroner or a funeral home director or anything than a podcast. He's a podcaster. Oh boy, great.
Great. How's that going?
That's so fucking funny. You never thought of that. You're right. It's embarrassing. I'm married to a podcaster. He has conversations. He has a beard. Oh, you're right, Lance. That's hilarious. You're the best, man. When are you coming to Austin again?
I think I'm going to bring Marshall back on some adventures coming up in a month or two.
Oh, you are? You got to let me know so we can hang out.
I will.
And like when
That'd
we're not working.
I wanted to go to that water park with you.
Kalahari?
Yeah.
Dude, we can go. You want to go?
Right?
We can go.
Yeah, I want to go.
Oh my God. Cause the kids would they would absolutely love it. They the oldest, when he's on the playground, it's so funny watching like 4-year olds meet, cause they don't know how to meet. Like you know what I mean? They're just learning how to, and like, but they're instant friends generally, you know? And so like watching him meet a kid and right away just be like, I went down some slides at Kalahari.
Such a great marker for development that like they know that that was an achievement, that they rose to the occasion, they summoned their courage, they did the thing.
Yeah, it's like what, you know, like a friend of mine was talking about, like, you know, riding in some like super fast race car, you know what I mean? It's like the same thing. I'm like, oh, you know, kind of went on some slides that maybe my dad made me stand on my tiptoes so I could even go on at Kalahari. Yes. I got in trouble for that. Yeah, man, please, let's do that. I mean, just so you know, it's like, look, I'm not going to try to like shit on it. Like, it's just, you know, it's an indoor water park. You know what that means, right? Yeah. Like with that, the steam, the heat, the piss in the water, the humidity, the disease everywhere. Just like, you know, if, you know, Wuhan.
Yes.
That's where we got COVID. the next one, it's going to come from Kalahari. Like, if I had to bet, it's just a perfect place for a new disease to emerge. And maybe we'll be the ones it emerges from, Lance.
We're the variants.
But we'll have fun. It's really fun. I mean, you could. It's fascinating. Lance, it would be so fun if you would come with us to Kalahari. And the kids will love you. Great. And thank you for doing this last second. And thank you for everything. I'm lucky to have you as a friend, man, as so many of us are. Like, you know, like people like you are rare out there. And like so many comics and so many artists, like we really like owe a lot to you. So thank you. Thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Love you, Duncan.
Love you. That was Lance Bangs, everybody. Definitely check out his new documentary, The Elephant Six Recording Company. A big thank you to our sponsors, and a tremendous thank you to Darien Ice Cream for giving all of us over here at the DTFH Studios ice cream baths. I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.